Can you hear me in back? Okay, fine. I'm going to talk about automating machine translation. Machine translation is often referred to as MT, from poorly studied languages. And in my talk with you this morning, I'd like to touch on 4 points. First of all, say a word about the goal of automatic translation or machine translation. Tell you a little bit about the history of automatic translation, about how it began in the early cybernetics period after World War II, and its resurgence over the last 10 to 15 years. Turn then to the problem of complex word structure and our solution, and then tell you a bit about what we're doing today. The goal of automatic translation is one that we've been talking about for a long time. The fact is that there are over 6,000 different human languages in use today in the world, and researchers need access to documents in virtually all of these languages over the long run. And defense analysts may need access to documents in any of these languages in situations where time is very much pressing. Many of you probably saw the movie about 2 years ago with Nicolas Cage, Wind Talkers, and it describes the way in which the United States used Navajo essentially as an encrypting system during World War II in the Pacific Theater. And where the United States is not the only country that can rely on using foreign languages as a complex means to encrypt information. This map gives you a little bit of a sense of the way in which the world's 6,000 or 7,000 languages are divided up into radically different language families, with languages not only whose vocabularies are radically different, but whose grammatical structure are radically different. If you look here, you get a sense, an accurate sense actually, that Africa is perhaps the most diverse linguistically, and that's true except for Papua New Guinea and Northern Australia. Native languages are even more varied. But leaving those small areas aside, Africa is a particularly complex area. If we look at just the major languages, just the languages of Africa alone, they're estimated to be about 1,500 languages, and it's only the very tiny countries like Rwanda and Burundi that have just a single language in them. Many of them, like Nigeria, which holds about 1/4 of the sub-Saharan population in Africa, has a number of languages. Here, Hausa, Yoruba, and Igbo are described, but there are hundreds of other languages which are widely spoken in Nigeria. We need to have access improved to documents in all of these languages. So the need for automatic translation is there. We don't have human translators that can operate over all of these languages, and we don't have them on 24/7 beck and call. This is a central problem of computational linguistics. Some people would say it's the Holy Grail. It's a great long-term goal. So what I'm going to talk to you about this morning is, first of all, to describe what it is that we're doing, and I'm going to try to give you a little bit of a feel for how it is that we do it. This is very difficult. I talk mostly to researchers who are in one of my two fields, either linguistics or computer science, and I can talk with them in their particular idiom. But to talk generally about the problems of computational approaches to natural language, you run into the problem that, on the one hand, when we specify the problem in the first place, it sounds so incredibly difficult that it sounds like science fiction, the idea that we could actually solve the problem. And then if I turn to an attempt to explain how it is that we intend to break the problem down into pieces and then solve it, sometimes it seems like it turns the problem into one that's simplicity itself. Well, the fact is that the methods are conceptually elegant. The analysis continues to be quite complex and much more quantitative than you're going to see in any of the slides today. Some people have suggested that the complexity of thoroughly analyzing a natural language, whether it's English or Kirundi, any natural human language, that the complexity of analyzing the whole language is of the same order of magnitude as, say, generating a biological cell from DNA. And that's also an extremely difficult program or project, but that's exactly the place where bioengineers are in terms of what they're trying to do next. I think the problems are essentially comparable. We're not trying to understand the whole language at this point. We're trying to cut into the problem. So what I'm going to talk to you about is a project which, like a number of workers in the field, is one that defines itself by goals of linguistics with the tools of computer science. Let me say a bit then about the history of machine translation. There may not be anybody here older than me today, in which case none of us remember the world before computers. I don't remember the world before computers. I was born after World War II. Computers came on the scene during World War II, and they were sponsored and funded and basically created by the United States and our allies, Great Britain. The Nazis in Germany were working on them as well. During World War II, there were two very important military reasons to have computers. One was to more accurately aim artillery, basically to solve differential equations very rapidly. And the other was based on the efforts to break the German and Japanese encryption systems. When World War II ended, there was a period of rapid reindustrialization, changeover in the goals of industry. Companies like IBM, for example. IBM decided to change from being a cash register manufacturing company and decided to make computers. The rest you know. Warren Weaver was the director of the Natural Sciences Division of the Rockefeller Foundation, and he was very, very interested in problems of natural language and the future of the computer. And he saw, as many far-sighted thinkers did at the time, he saw that there was more to the problem of decryption than met the eye. He wrote in a widely distributed but private memo in July of 1949, it's very tempting to say that a book written in Chinese is simply a book written in English, which was coded into the Chinese code. If we have useful methods for solving almost any cryptographic problem, may it not be that with proper interpretation, we already have useful tools for translation? So he was saying, let's piggyback on a technology and a mathematics that we already know quite a bit about. There were many efforts during the 1950s, and they involved computers like that one there. It's huge. It's gigantic, and it's nowhere near as powerful as any of the computers that you have in front of you and that I'm working with here. The work in the 1950s was stymied by both the lack of sufficient computing power, in the same way that an effort to uncover the DNA sequence of a human cell, or for that matter, any cell, would have been stymied by computational power in the 50s. And it was also stymied by immature computing technology at that point. Computer science was just getting off the ground. I found recently a very interesting, very short clip. I'd like to share it with you. It's from January 1954. It's got some sound here. Because it's a little bit grainy, I just want to tell you how it starts out. I think after you hear the first few words, you'll be able to hear it fine. It starts out, they hadn't reckoned with ambiguity when they set out to use computers to translate languages. So let's listen to it.
They hadn't reckoned with ambiguity when they set out to use computers.
You're not seeing it, huh?
Languages.
A $500,000 supercalculator, the most versatile electronic brain known, translates Russian into English. Instead of mathematical wizardry, a sentence in Russian is to be fed.
One of the first non-numerical applications of computers, it was hyped as the solution to the Cold War obsession of keeping tabs on what the Russians were doing. Claims were made that the computer would replace most human translators.
At present, of course, you're just in the experimental stage. When you go in for full-scale production, what will the capacity be?
We should be able to do about, with a modern commercial computer, about 1 to 2 million words an hour. And this will be quite an adequate speed to cope with the whole output of the Soviet Union in just a few hours computer time a week.
When do you hope to be able to achieve this speed?
I'm sorry you didn't see the video. It brings you back to the old days of the early 50s, but you heard the sound that went with it. Let's hope the computer is... There we go. Progress in this area was incremental at best during the 1970s and 1980s in the United States. Funding had dropped precipitously in the United States, although not outside, in Europe and in Japan. But in the 1990s, something happened, essentially technological or intellectually, that caused a major sea change in computational linguistics based on data-driven statistical techniques. And essentially what happened, the change that took place, was something similar to what Warren Weaver expected to happen. But he thought that we would piggyback on decrypting technology. What happened was researchers decided to piggyback on speech recognition technology, on the mathematics that had been developed for speech recognition, which itself was funded by DARPA at the time. And IBM research in the late 80s, early 90s, developed an approach to translation that was based on systems that learn from examples. Now, this truly sounds like science fiction, and people were totally aghast at this possibility. So this is the conception now. Instead of a programmer or a linguist or both sitting down and writing a program that translates, let's say, from Russian to English, the goal is this, to create that gray box in the middle. That's what the IBM researchers were proposing that we, the profession, should do. To create a learning system, that box in the middle, which is language independent. It has no knowledge of English or Russian or Swahili. Think of it basically as a baby growing up in a bilingual environment. It takes as its input those two books on the left. That's a text in two different languages. It could be the Bible in Russian and English. It could be the Quran. It could be technical manuals for Boeing aircraft. It doesn't matter what the texts are. Ideally, the text will be similar to those things which you'd like to translate in the future. The goal of such a system is not to translate any text. The goal of the system, the output of the system, is software. It's a program that would translate from one language to the other. That's a really remarkable perspective. This idea was extremely interesting. A couple of papers were published on this, and then for various reasons, primarily business reasons, IBM dropped this project. The people who were working on it went into other areas. And it wasn't developed until 1999, when the National Science Foundation funded a summer project at Johns Hopkins. They developed a system called EGYPT, which was an attempt to rebuild what IBM had done at the had already done, but it was proprietary. The EGYPT project was and still is open source. It's widely used in research. It's difficult to use in practice. It really requires a hacker to know it and love it. And this is something that we've begun to use, and I'll come back to what we can do in order to make it much more easy to use in actual practice. So let's think a little bit about what it means to translate. Do we translate sentences? What is it that we translate? One's first thought may be that we translate sentences, and in a sense it is. As I was preparing these slides, I went to Google News and I picked the first French sentence that I saw. And it was this: l'entourage de Chirac est plus imperméable que celui de Nicolas Sarkozy. So translated as Chirac's inner circle is more impenetrable than that of Nicolas Sarkozy. Well, that's fine. Yes, we're translating a sentence, and yes, we've got the translation right if each sentence translates into the appropriate other sentence. But in fact, it's not just at the level of the sentence that we want to translate. A sentence is a conglomeration of two things. It's a collection of words, and it's a set of patterns that describe the way the words are put together. It's left to right order, and it's more than that. What's the subject? What's the verb? What's the object? So when we translate, we're really doing two things. We're translating words, and we're translating the constructions, the way the words are put together. And so the IBM model said, we're going to break the problem down into these two parts. Let's figure out how words translate, and let's figure out how word order and constructions translate. If all we were doing is literally translating sentences, and if our initial training corpus, that's those two books that served as input that I said could be the Bible or Boeing aircraft technical manuals, if every sentence that we ever cared about appeared in that original training corpus, we would have its translation and we could go home. There would be nothing to do. But the challenge is always to go beyond the training data to extend that knowledge by knowledge of how words translate and how constructions translate. So the key word here, and I'm going to come back to this, is sparsity of the data. This is a phrase that computational linguists use all the time. Meaning, if we had every sentence you'd ever want to translate in the original data, you'd have the translation, but you don't. So you have to figure out how to extend from what you've got to all future possibilities. It's called data sparseness because what you want to translate tomorrow, you've never seen before. The data that you've already seen is, in that sense, too sparse. So here's an example, get a little bit more concrete, of how people approach the translation process. We're going to start with a large set of sentences, which are translations one of another. They've been created by a bilingual human being, or team of human beings. But those people have not aligned the words. So take these two sentences here. On the bottom, we've got English, the dog sat down on the rug. And on the top, we have le chien s'est assis sur le tapis, which, of course, means the dog sat down on the rug. So the system is given the two sentences, but it's not given those lines that connect them. And the first part of the challenge for the system is to figure out those lines. What words correspond to what words? I've given a particularly simple example here, partly because English and French are so similar. The word order in a very simple sentence like this is almost lines up perfectly. If I had thrown an adjective in, so instead of just saying the dog, I'd said the white dog, the lines would have crossed because an adjective precedes a noun in English, it follows a noun in French. If we were looking at Japanese, the verb would always be at the end. In English, it's not. So the task of finding the connections between the words is a difficult one, but it's the first one. So the first task is to find out the word-to-word matchings and then to figure out the alignments. Again, that means the patterns of those lines across the source and target languages. Say source Russian, target English. How the word orders differ. And as I just mentioned, French and English are quite similar. Japanese and Korean would be different because the verb always appears at the end of a sentence. Let me give you just a tiny little taste for how we'd proceed, the first step of trying to find word-to-word alignment. What I've given you here is the simplest possible corpus. It's basically four words of French, four words of English. What we really need is a million words in French and a million words of English, but just to give you a feel. And these sentences are so short that they're not even full sentences. So on the left, it's the phrase in English, the dog, and in French, le chien. On the right, the cat in English, le chat in French. This is our corpus. The system comes with no knowledge as to how the words line up. So that's why I've put in all of those lines. That's the way the system's saying at the beginning, I don't know what corresponds to what, and any combination is possible. That null there is there because we often find that a word in one language corresponds to nothing in the other language. So we have to include null as a possibility because it may correspond to nothing in. There may be a word in French corresponding to nothing in English, or vice versa. Okay, so what we do, I'm not going to run through all these numbers here, but I want to give you a real quick sense of the quantitative side here. We focus on each word in the French, and we say, what's the probability that each of the words in English was its source? We calculate probabilities. We use those to calculate what are called estimated counts. And at the beginning, we have no knowledge as to what null in English translates to. That lack of knowledge quantitatively translates into this 0.33, 0.33, 0.33. See, that's the computer's way of saying, I don't know if null translates into le or cha or chien. I just don't know, and there's no way. I just don't know. Similarly, the may translate into any of those. Dog, however, translates either into le or chien, and cat into either le or cha. That's the state at which it has no knowledge. We compute the probabilities, we recompute estimated counts, and this chart here should give you a little bit of a sense of what happens. There's four boxes here. This is the initial no knowledge, one iteration, two iterations, and here's after five iterations. What's happened here is now that the word the thinks that the chances are basically 3 out of 4 that it translates into le, and only 1 out of 8 that it translates into sha, or for that matter, into chien. Dog, similarly, thinks it has basically only 1 chance in 6 of being translated as le, and 5 out of 6 is being translated into chien. And that's on the basis of 4 words in each language. So looking at the words and recalculating the probabilities gives us the beginning of knowledge as to what words correspond to what across languages. That strengthens our understanding of which links are accurate, which ones are correct, and then we build up knowledge of the grammar. Okay, so
what do you mean by iterations?
So the first time around we have a uniform distribution over probabilities. We calculate estimated counts. We take those counts again and recalculate the probabilities in effectively an estimation maximization So we do that iteratively. Each set of estimated counts creates a new set of probabilities, and each iteration gives us a probabilistic model which will assign a higher probability to the data. So it's essentially EM max iteration. Okay, what I've been describing to you is the standard way in the field at this point for doing statistical for developing statistical approaches to machine translation. What we have to offer here that's special here, meaning University of Chicago, that's special is our approach to morphology. What is morphology? Morphology is the study of the internal structure of words. So the word words, for example, in English, contains a stem word, which means word, and a suffix s, which means plural, essentially. The word findings, for example, is a little more complex, so that it's not a particularly recherché word. It has a suffix s. The stem itself, finding, is composed of a stem find and a suffix ing. If we turn to another language, Swahili, which is one of the languages that my group is working on, you have a word like tunakisema, which we would translate as we speak it. And that's a single verb, but it has four meaningful parts. Tu means we, na is a present tense indicator, ki means it, and speak is a translation of sema. European languages, which are the ones that most of us, including many of the people who did early work on machine translation, are familiar with, European languages, from a morphological point of view, are very simple. Most languages of the world are more complex morphologically than European languages. And the consequence for machine translation is this, that we need to think about translating the pieces of the words, what linguists call morphemes, not the words themselves. Because the words themselves are too sparse. In the same sense that sentences are too sparse, words are too sparse in most languages. Only a small subset of the words that we're going to see in the future were already in your training corpus. So you've got to break the corpus down into the meaningful pieces. So the next question is, how do we find those morphemes? That's the problem that I've been working on with my students since 1997, and we have a project which itself is an open source project. It has a web page, linguistica.uchicago.edu, and its core engine is an automatic morphology analyzer. It learns the morphological structure of a language directly from a written sample with no human intervention. Now, it's always a challenge to figure out how to present this to a group of people, because the only language that I can assume that you have in front of you, that you have at your fingertips is English. And seeing a computer solve the problem of English at first blush may not be quite surprising because you've already solved the problem. But I'm going to show you what we've got anyway. So bear in mind that the system has no initial knowledge at all about English. It takes about 15 seconds to analyze 200,000 words of English, which is like a large novel. It's a C++. It's written in C++ code. It operates very, very rapidly. And it operates under Windows, the Mac operating system, and Linux as well. Let me show you here. Hope you can see it. Here, let me go back, in fact, show you this next slide. I'll come back to the program. What the program looks for are combinations of stems and suffixes. Because when it finds combinations like that, it knows that it's hit on something accurate. So what we see here is it finds patterns like account, appeal, arrest, and 87 more in this column, all of which are followed by the suffixes null, ed, ing, s. That means it's found the word account, accounted, accounting, and accounts. And I'm going to emphasize it and underscore it as much as I can. It did that without any knowledge that these were the suffixes of English. It figured that out from the data, and it found that there were these stems that had exactly those suffixes. Similarly, the stems bright, loud, strong appeared with these suffixes, null, er, est, ly. Those are adjectives, and these are the suffixes that adjectives can take. Similarly, it found Adair, Belaguer, Blanchard with the suffixes null, that is to say no suffix, and apostrophe s. So it finds the grammatically significant pieces, the morphemes, of the language. This is not a screenshot. This is the program. And we click here on the combinations of suffixes that are found. And as you can see here, null s, apostrophe s, null, null, e, d, i, and g, s. It's located, it's analyzed, these set of suffixes that co-occur with parts of speech. One of the things that we're working on currently, a very difficult problem, turns out to be more difficult than the one I've just described, is figuring out compound words in English, a problem that arises in quite a number of languages. It's quite difficult to analyze them. And if you can read this here, what this shows here is four analyses of the word brinkmanship. And the first is the one that's chosen, and it's broken the word down into brink and man, and then ship. But there's other possibilities if you don't know the language and you're just a computer. Brinkmans, for example, followed by hip, and brink followed by man, ship, and so forth. But the program considers all these possibilities, and it picks the right one, which is the first in this case. Compounds. So English uses compounds heavily. Here's another example. Battleground is the one that it selects, and it figures out that that's better than bat, leg, round, and also another analysis of bat, leg, round. Okay, where we stand today. Our project is involved in working on four particular directions that are closely linked. Improving automatic morphology, integrating the Egypt statistical machine translation into our package for easy application. Third, improving translation by using morphology. And fourth, testing it on Swahili and English. I'll just briefly give you a sense. The challenge of dealing with Swahili and other rich languages is one where the work that I've done that was just mentioned earlier on bioinformatics comes very much into the field of application. In languages where words can have several subpieces, we're using techniques that have been borrowed from bioinformatics in order to break words up into pieces in exactly the same way that we break the genome up into genes and other control pieces. We take those pieces and out of them build a structure like this. This is how the Swahili verb is built. It starts with a subject marker, followed by a tense marker, followed by an object marker, a root, a voice marker, and a final, final, doesn't want me to stay on that. All right. So we're building technology that can learn much more complicated structure. We're building the Egypt machine translation software into our program. Since it is so open source, we can do it, making it easier for anybody to use. We're developing ways to integrate our morphology into translation. And at this point, we're testing it with Swahili. There are translations of eight of the books from the Bible that are available on the internet, which is what we use as our so-called gold standard these days. I'll stop there and invite your questions.